Boom or bust, the future of Maine's lobster industry. Just like farmers, Maine lobstermen face any number of challenges in a given season. Bait prices, fuel prices, demand, and perhaps most importantly, supply. Too many lobsters and the price drops. Too few and you can't pay the bills. But some researchers believe that the biggest challenge facing the entire lobster industry is climate change. That warming ocean temperatures are steadily driving the center of the Maine lobster population northward, up the coast, and over the course of decades will slide completely up into Canada. I'm Keith Shortall, and today on the program we'll talk with the author of The Last Lobster, Boom or Bust for Maine's Great Fishery. We'll also get perspectives from two other scientists who work closely with Maine's lobstering communities. The future of lobstering. First, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Keith Shortall, and this is Maine Calling. Maine is inexorably tied to lobster. It's not only our state's largest and most lucrative fishery, it's a major part of our culture and heritage. We would, of course, want to know about any possible threats to the fishery and what those threats might mean for people who make a living lobstering and for the character of the coastal communities. We'll learn more today about what that future might hold. Joining us from the studios of KSFR in Santa Fe is Christopher White. He's a science writer and naturalist and the author of The Last Lobster, Boom or Bust for Maine's Greatest Fishery. Chris has written five other books and numerous articles, often focusing on the environment and how it relates to working people and communities. And as always, we want to hear from you. Do you live in a community with lobstermen? How important are lobsters to Maine? Are you concerned about the effects of climate change on the Gulf of Maine? The phone number is 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Chris White, welcome to the program.
Good morning.
So the book is really based on this question that you raise, boom or bust, which is in the title. And you make the case here that I guess in the short term, there may be a boom, but as warmer waters contribute to boosted reproduction and bigger harvests, et cetera, but that as the ocean temperatures continue to rise due to climate change, the center of the lobster population it moves northward and eventually may move out of Maine altogether. Does that capture, I guess, kind of the premise of your book?
Yes, it does. The irony is, the great irony really, is that the same factors that have influenced the boom or the glut that Maine has enjoyed for the last 6 or 7 years also spell trouble for them with a coming possible downturn in the lobster harvest.
So does that, because it's contributing to this boom, does it make it harder to have that discussion, to embrace this idea that the temperatures will continue to rise and that it will be a bad thing eventually?
Well, yes, because it's totally unexpected. You know, it took a while for especially lobstermen to get used to the idea that climate change was bringing on the boom. And now on top of that, now they have to come to terms with the fact that the climate change and the warming of the ocean and the Gulf of Maine might mean that a very large downturn might occur, which is double trouble for them. Because the boom wasn't all a good thing. It wasn't everything about it wasn't good. When I set out to do this book, I mean, I was interested in the challenge confronting lobstermen today, and so I examined the life and times of the Maine lobstermen, but I was really interested in what was the meaning behind the boom. And it turned out that, of course, the boom had been coming for quite a while. In the 1980s, the annual lobster catch in Maine was about 25 million pounds. And then it doubled in the 1990s to 50 million pounds and kept doubling, so that by 2012, it had sextupled, and it was now six times what it had been in the 1980s, and we had 120 million pounds of lobsters being catched. But everyone, you know, at first blush, you would think, well, that's great. Everyone's got more lobsters. But there are problems with that. With the oversupply of lobsters, it meant that The distribution pipeline couldn't handle distributing the lobsters, and also the price dropped significantly. In 2012, the price went from around $4 a pound at dockside paid to the lobstermen down to $2. That meant a 50% drop in money in the lobsterman's pocket.
So there really has to be the sweet spot, right? You don't want so many lobsters that there's a glut and the bottom falls out of the price. But you certainly want there to be a sustainable, large enough number that you don't have a shortage as well, right? There's a sweet spot that you'd like to maintain.
Well, that's absolutely true, but we don't know exactly what that sweet spot is yet, where it's going to even out. And there are differing opinions upon what the future holds. The Gulf of Maine Research Institute in Portland is saying that it did was funded by the National Science Foundation, $1.5 million to do a study on the future of lobsters in the Gulf of Maine. And they came up with a forecast that by 2050, the population of lobsters was going to decrease anywhere between 42% to 60%. So that's certainly not a sweet spot.
And so that means basically that what the center, as we call it, of the lobster population, you point out in the book, has already been moving north, right? So it was once further south in Maine and is now somewhere around where you decided to set up shop to do research for your book?
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, this is something that I had no idea about when I first set out to do this book on the lobstermen of Maine. I found a professor at Rutgers University named Malin Pinsky, who had done a survey of 360 marine species in the western North Atlantic and discovered that all of them were moving northward and at different velocities. He called them climate velocities, because the ocean, the warming of the oceans was driving these species to move northward. It turned out that the American lobster was moving at a rate of 4.3 miles per year. That's a lot. That's a huge amount. That's 43 miles per decade. And that meant that the lobster species, the population, was centered off Long Beach Island, New Jersey in 1968. But by 2008, 40 years later, it was off Boston. And within the Gulf of Maine, similarly, the local lobster population was moving north at about 3 miles per year, I calculated, and was moving from Casco Bay off Portland in the 1970s up to the northern part of Penobscot Bay today, which meant that every time the lobsters moved, whatever lobster village was in proximity to that peak population was doing the best. Casco Bay and Portland lobstermen are no longer doing well. They were, but now it's all Stonington that's doing the best because the peak of the population is right offshore in Penobscot Bay.
Great. I'd like to bring in Carla Gunther. She's a senior scientist with the Maine Center for Coastal Fisheries. Carla, welcome to the program.
Hello. Good afternoon.
So, Carla, first, just explain a little bit about what the center does.
Well, here at the Maine Center for Coastal Fisheries, our facility is located here on the waterfront in Stonington. So we have been the largest lobster port for the past about 5 years running. And we work with fishermen, not just lobstermen, but our scallopers and our clammers and everyone else here, from Stonington to the Canadian border to, do research and integrate and learn new things for management choices.
So I'm not sure when you came online and heard the conversation earlier with Chris, but I know you're familiar with his book. I guess I'd ask your reaction to this premise that the lobster population, the center of it, is moving northward, and this bigger alarm that continued warming may move the population, you know, up and out of Maine altogether. How would you assess the lobster population currently?
Well, the lobster population is still doing pretty well. There's been great debate of the past 2 years, more or less. We're very lucky in the state of Maine in that we're so dependent on lobster that we also invest a lot of money in understanding the animal. And we have about four different surveys that the state conducts to monitor lobster populations at different life stages. And the settlement survey, which measures the one-year-old lobsters, that has shown a decline over the past 10 years that has led to largely that Gulf of Maine Research Institute prediction. But then we also have a short lobster survey. It's called ventless traps, which, because they don't have vents, they will keep the lobsters that are about 2 to 3 years younger than legal size. And the state has been doing ventless trap surveys for, I think, almost 20 years, 15, 20 years. And we still have large numbers of ventless animals coming in. So the short animals are still being seen in large numbers. Those do not show a downturn in the lobster population.
Mm-hmm. So those are the sort of the more immediate measures, I guess. What do you think of this bigger question, or the vision, the possibility of the population moving continuously northward, driven by warmer temperatures, and what the consequences might be for the lobster fishery?
Yeah. So we work pretty closely with a lot of these communities to talk about what is our vision for diversification, because unfortunately, with climate change and with overfishing and a few other complications, we have become largely dependent on lobster, practically solely dependent on lobster. So what are opportunities for diversification? And one of the really big questions is, how long will it take for the lobster bubble, if you will, for the lobster center of the population to shift north? I don't think we're going to lose lobster altogether. It's a very resilient animal, but the boom has caused us to be more socially and economically dependent on lobster than what is, desired or safe. So what we really need to be doing is looking at what our diversification options are. And we look at what are other fishery options. So along with lobster shifting north, there are lots of other species that Dr. Pinsky has noted are also moving north. How long will those species take to establish themselves in the Gulf of Maine? And how do fishermen here in Maine get access to fish those fisheries?
So we could take advantage, I guess, what you're saying, of the warming waters rather than respond in some defensive way.
Yeah. I mean, I think we're going to have to also think of how are we going to sustain, because we don't know whether the timelines overlap yet.
Yeah. Chris White, I just want to go back to you and follow up on this a little bit of what Carla said about, well, the center of the population may be moving northward, but it doesn't necessarily point to a major, you know, decline or collapse of the fishery in southern waters zones. But you point to what happened in Long Island, New York, as maybe a harbinger of what's to come.
Yes, of course. I do use Long Island as an example of what went wrong with the effect of climate change on a body of water. But we have to remember that Long Island Sound and the Gulf of Maine are two very different ecosystems, totally different. One of the pressures on the lobsters in Long Island Sound was that they were close to the southern limit of their range when they're in Long Island Sound, and so they were already ready to be taxed in terms of any heat load that was coming along. But I agree with Carla totally about what we need to do is look at what are the options for Maine fishermen moving forward. And the fact that, as she points out, that Maine lobstermen are so vulnerable because 80% of the catch by dollar value in Maine is lobsters, which means that they're really vulnerable to any downturn that might happen, whether it's price or population or disease or any other downturn that could occur. So diversifying is definitely a very smart way to go.
Carla, we're talking about temperature a lot here in this discussion of climate change and the effects that it's having on the lobster population, but it also has effects on other factors that affect the lobster population, such as predators, for example, right? What can we say about the changes that are happening in the ocean and how they affect the natural predators of lobster and what's happening there?
Well, I think that's also a great debate, but I think both overfishing and climate change helped some of the predators, the natural predators of lobster, decline in population, such as the groundfish species.
The codfish.
Codfish, haddock, hake, yep. And those were the natural predators, and we have smaller fish. The fish that are still here are much smaller, and they are only able to eat a smaller-sized lobster. And here in eastern Maine, where we also see the large population of lobster, we have basically extirpated the population of codfish. So not only are we in the sweet temperature spot for lobster, but we also have an expansion of potential habitat that the lobsters don't need to hang out in the cobble in order to be protected from predators.
So are they also moving out into deeper water?
Mm-hmm.
And so therefore harder to reach by traditional fishing?
Well, I don't know. I mean, a trap, you just need to add more rope to it to go to deeper waters for lobster. But I think also what's happened is that the inshore lobsters, fishermen will always talk of groundkeepers, that this inshore-offshore migration may have happened for a portion of the population for lobster, but there's always been this groundkeeper population, the lobsters that just bury themselves in the mud when the water gets cooler inshore. And so I think what we've also just seen is instead of lobsters just moving offshore, we've also seen a retention of a portion of the population, maybe a larger portion of the population, becoming groundkeepers because they can hang out in the mud. They don't have to fear for predators.
Chris, bait, we haven't brought up bait, I think, at this point. Bait is a big issue because it's a major expense. There are sometimes shortages, and it's critical, obviously, to catching lobster. How does the bait issue play into this and with respect to climate change? Does climate change affect the availability and price of bait?
Well, here's another challenge that the Maine lobstermen have. It seems like at every corner they have another challenge coming at them. And right now there's talk underway of decreasing the quota of herring bait next year in 2019 by, I think it's 47%. Is that right, Carla?
Yes. Yeah,
47%. And so that's going to put a real crimp on the lobstermen because with the quota going way down and there not being as much herring on the market, there's going to be a price increase naturally that will occur because of supply and demand in the bait price. And they're talking about a barrel of bait now costing $500 a piece, which means that lobstermen are going to have a much larger part of their catch going towards overhead, and that's going to put a lot of pressure on them.
I read in your book that some fishermen had been forced to go to cat food.
Yeah, that's Julie Eaton told me that she when the herring was cut off, they actually a couple of years ago, I can't remember what summer it was, but the herring catch for bait was suspended for a few weeks or a month or two, and she turned to tuna heads and cat food and all sorts of other possibilities that she could get at the grocery store for bait.
All right, we're going to take a quick break here. Carla, thank you for joining us. I appreciate the time.
Okay, thank you. Have a good one.
Carla Gunther is a PhD in marine science and is a senior scientist with the Maine Center for Coastal Fisheries. As I said, we'll take a quick break. When we come back, your comments and questions, the number to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do CMCA in Rockland, now showing artists Jocelyn Lee, John Bisbee, and Tom Burkhart. CMCANow.org. And the Claremont Hotel, featuring Xanthus Restaurant in Southwest Harbor, and online at theclaremonthotel.com.
Mainers are struggling to pay the rent, and they're being evicted from neighborhoods across the state. Last year, more than 5,700 eviction cases were filed with the courts. For some, eviction leads to homelessness. For others, it means doubling up with friends and relatives, continually uprooting children, missing school, and missing work.
Told myself it was the last time it was going to happen, and I just feel bad for letting down my kids and all that.
I'm on a fixed income. I'm retired, and there isn't one $500 apartment. They're all $750, $850. It's insane.
What's being done to address this crisis? I'm Susan Sharon. Join us for a week-long special series, Eviction, Life Unpacked, on Morning Edition, Maine Things Considered, and online, beginning Monday, August 6th.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Jennifer Fox about writing and directing the Emmy-nominated HBO film The Tale, based on her experience being sexually abused at age 13 by her running coach. It took her years to realize that the story she told herself then, that this was a relationship based on love, was really a story of child sexual abuse. Join us.
And join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 o'clock.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, the outlook for Maine's lobster fishery. Joining me on the line from Santa Fe, Chris White. He's the author of a new book about the future of lobsters in Maine entitled The Last Lobster. We invite you to join the conversation. The number 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Chris White, we'll get back into the science a little bit in a minute, but I wanted to talk a little bit more about your approach to the book and the research that went into it. And beyond the science, you spend a lot of time painting a portrait of the people, the families, and the places that are central to the lobstering industry and to its culture, which is a big part of the Maine culture. And I wonder if you could tell us how you settled on setting up your base camp down east in Stonington instead of some of the spots further south that are well known, such as, you know, Booth Bay Harbor, Tennant's Harbor, or Port Clyde.
Okay, well, I wanted to find one of the most authentic fishing villages and lobster villages in Maine to have as a base camp. And so Stonington drew me for a couple of reasons. The first is because of what we've just been talking about with Carla, that the peak of the lobster population was right offshore for the last couple of years. And so, because it had moved north from Portland and Casco Bay. And so that was important. I wanted to know how the local lobstermen were handling the boom right where it was at its peak. So that was one key thing. Then the other thing is I just wanted it to be very authentic because I felt that the lobstermen of Maine are such a treasure to the state and to New England, and it's so important that they survive and thrive. And to do that, they have a lot of challenges on their hands right now, and I wanted to find out how they were handling that. I saw Stonington as really a microcosm of what's happening around the world with different communities trying to deal with climate change and trying to do it as well as they can. So that was my attraction.
So you saw Stonington as also somewhat less tainted by outside impacts. I noted in one background piece, I think you were talking about one of the gauges was how far you look for houses with traps in the front yard, and then how far away from the water those houses were.
Right. Well, we have to remember that originally there were over 100 lobster villages in Maine that were really pure lobster villages. The only people living in the villages were basically lobstermen or dealers or wholesalers or restaurateurs selling lobster, people dealing with the lobster industry. And that's changed with more and more tourism coming up the coast. But as tourism has come up the coast, outsiders outside of Maine have come in and bought up property, and the coast has become gentrified in the southern reaches of Maine. And I found that up down east that it wasn't gentrified, and that attracted me.
We're going to be joined now by Bob Stenick. He's a marine biologist with the Darling Marine Center and a professor in the School of Marine Sciences at the University of Maine. Bob, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good to be here.
I wondered if we could just start off with your impression. You're familiar with Chris's book. And I guess this idea, the warning that because of ocean temperatures and some of these other pressures, that the lobster population is moving northward up the coast. Give us your take, I guess, on that view of the future.
Right. Well, all those statistics are correct, but I think there's often a misconception, which is that because the center of landings, where the greatest number of landings are coming in, is moving to the north, that they must be declining in western Maine. But that is not the case. You know, you look at the landings for York County and Cumberland County, all of western Maine, everything west and south of Penobscot Bay has been actually increasing. But the big difference is the huge increase that's occurred in eastern Maine, Washington and Hancock County. And that is such a big increase that it's actually just shifted that center of gravity, you know, to the Stonington region.
So you sound somewhat optimistic, or more optimistic, I guess, about all of this in terms of the potential for drastic declines in the near future. What are your concerns about the Maine lobster fishery in the long term?
Right. Well, it's true. I don't see the imminent decline that some people are worried about, and I think the scientific community is coming around to that. But Carla touched on, I think, the biggest concern I have, and that is this remarkably high, and Chris, of course, highlighted it in the book, this remarkably high dependence on a single species. And on that point, I just wanted to add, I think Chris picking Stonington was a really good choice, in part because if you look at the dependency on marine resources east of Penobscot Bay, it's just huge in Maine. And so you've got such a great economic diversity in areas around Portland, you name it, Casco Bay. The effect of any change would not be as great as it would be in eastern Maine. And I totally agree with him about you know, the lobster traps and boats you'll see off season on the front yards of coastal property, which you see in that region of the coast, and that is a tradition, and that's our maritime heritage. And if anything happens to this species, we are in trouble.
I was at a wedding. I'll tell you a personal story. I was at a wedding this weekend in Tennant's Harbor with some lobstermen, and they were remarking at how, you know, 20 years ago, that harbor would have been filled with lobster boats, and that it was now mostly filled with sailboats and pleasure craft. Is that a visual indication of kind of what you're talking about?
Well, you know, the gentrification, of course, is already happening, and there's no question about that. I certainly have, I know areas along the coast where harbors have essentially divided, where you've got yachts in one portion and then the lobster fleet in the other portion. But really, since 1995, when they set up the zones and have limited entry, the number of people fishing has declined somewhat. But the number of traps and the effort is about the same in terms of the number of traps. But one point that's been raised is that many more people are fishing offshore, and these are larger boats. They're going out a lot farther. They've got two or sometimes more sternmen, and so you're not going to see quite as many small boats necessarily fishing what we call the shoal water.
Yeah. 1-800-399-3566 to join the conversation. We'll bring in some calls now. We'll go to Cyrus in Spruce Head. Hi, Cyrus. Welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Sure, go ahead.
I wanted to just make a point referencing back to the earlier conversation about the landing statistics. And there's it's been acknowledged that the statistics might be a little skewed for a few reasons. First of them is that the landings reporting got better as throughout the 90s. And, as far as the IRS landings reporting and all that was concerned, so that we actually were seeing more lobsters landed than we used to, just because for the fact that it was being reported better. And another reason why the landing statistics took a big jump in the early 90s was when that was when the wire trap became prevalent, which is a much more efficient trap than the wooden trap. It allowed people to haul more traps And that really affected the amount of lobsters that were being caught without really increasing the effort. So what I was trying to get at is that this boom that we're seeing in lobster, yes, it is partly due to, well, the reasons that Chris is talking about, but another, there is other factors involved.
Sure.
That,
two good points. You know, sorry, I don't mean to cut you off. I want to get reaction first from Bob, I guess, on the technology. Has technology helped with the increased take?
Well, no question. I mean, people don't fish with wooden traps anymore because the wire traps work better. You know, that is a factor. On the other hand, you only have so many harvestable lobsters in a region, and when you look at the size distribution, you'll find that a very high percentage of those lobsters do get harvested on an annual basis. So what I've been doing for decades is actually doing demographic surveys underwater. And the population increase, we actually recorded it, you know, on the seafloor. This is not using traps at all. So the increase is real, but there are these other factors in terms of how people fish and where they fish and how efficiently they fish. We mentioned inshore versus offshore. These things are going to have an effect. But overall, what we're seeing, I think, is a much bigger impact from, you know, this sweet spot, because we know baby lobsters need a certain warm temperature, and we've just gone over that warm temperature in eastern Maine, so it's increased the nursery habitat significantly. That's really increased overall statewide landings.
And the increased temperature, Bob, also makes the female lobsters fertile at a younger age?
It's true. The lobsters will reach, you know, they'll start bearing eggs at much smaller size. I mean, even if you go down to places like Boston Harbor, you'll see very small lobsters with eggs. As you move up to the Bay of Fundy, they're much, much larger. And that's been well known. It's been known for really over a century. But as water temperatures warm, you will see some smaller lobsters bearing eggs, and I certainly hear a lot of lobstermen saying that to me all the time.
Yeah.
Anecdotal information could be really interesting, and I can't say how many times during the research I did on this book that I was out on lobster boats where a captain said, "Look at this," and he would pull a small lobster that was really too small to keep on board the boat. But because of the minimum size, but it was a fertile female.
Right, right. Let's go to Rockland and Weston. Hi, Weston. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Good afternoon. I just wanted to take a couple of minutes. My father, about 50 years ago, looked out across the bay and screamed, and he says, "Look at all those lobster ponds out there." He says, "There's not going to be any lobsters out there at all. They're going to fish them to death." And I didn't argue with my father, because he was not the kind of guy you argued with. But I was thinking to myself, well, you know, they feed those baby lobsters until they get big enough to keep. So as far as I'm concerned, that's aquaculture in the purest sense of the form. It's like a renewable resource. And the other comment I had to say was Mr. White talked about a six-fold increase in the amount of lobsters that were being taken in. And then he said, well, the price dropped to half. So that meant the lobsterman was making half what he was before. When I do the math, it comes out that he's making three times as much as he did before.
All right. Weston, thank you. Chris, did you want to clarify any math?
No. I was talking about per lobster is what the price I was talking about.
Right, not the overall earnings.
Right.
Yeah. Weston, thank you very much. For joining us today. Appreciate it. Let's go to John in Jefferson. Hi, John.
Hello. Good. Thank you. I want to talk about the diversity issue. I am very frustrated that I can't find Maine mackerel in any store ever. And it's an abundant resource. I try to catch them sometimes off the Rockland breakwater because I like to fish. I can't catch them. There's nothing there most of the time. But I know they're offshore. And why are nobody selling mackerel? I know people buy them for bait for the stripers, but for commercial, ordinary citizens, why aren't they in the markets?
I have to say, I fish the breakwater, too, and I have the same luck that you do, John, for mackerel. But I remember as a kid just pulling them in one after the other in Rockland Harbor. Is there any reason for that, Bob?
Well, you know, there are a lot. The coast is incredibly dynamic. And, for example, this year we have a lot of menhaden, which locally are called pogies. And I know that there's a lot of predators going after them. I also know that we have more seals on the coast of Maine than we've ever had before. And mackerel happen to be a really good size for seals to eat. And these dynamics are really striking. I have seen mackerel in the Booth Bay region recently. So they're going to be patchy. And, you know, these dynamics are complicated. Trying to get a handle on how the ecosystem is changing with these changing predators, the reduction of the ground fish, increases of seals, these are complicated and hard to really encapsulate as in terms of tight scientific predictions.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, but first, a word about tomorrow's show. Join host Jennifer Rooks to learn about historic sites in Maine, interesting and meaningful places to visit across the state. Email your comments and questions to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet us or post to our Facebook page. The number to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Healthy Living for Me. Online information and in-person classes about healthy living for seniors. Learn more at healthylivingforme.org.
Brian Brown fled his California home when fire threatened.
A police officer pulls down there. He then yells at us, "Get out now!" And there's three helicopters right above our house, ready to drop water.
I'm Ari Shapiro. With record-setting wildfires in California, we'll ask, is there a better way to fight them? Weighing the options for fighting fires this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 each weekday evening.
On the next Speaking in Maine, the first in our series from the 2018 Champlain Institute.
I think there's a tremendous amount of puzzlement in Europe. Is the U.S. still our ally?
Our politics have changed, but so have Europe's. This is not your father's EU.
College of the Atlantic brings us a discussion on U.S. relations with the European Union, featuring ambassadors Bill Eco, Boyden Gray, and Jim Lowenstein. That's coming up on Speaking in Maine, Wednesday afternoon at 2 on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, we're talking about Maine's lobster fishery. Joining us today, Chris White, senior writer and author of the new book, The Last Lobster, and Bob Stenick, marine biologist and UMaine professor. Join the conversation. Give us a call. The number, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. I did want to ask you, Chris, about the tariffs that have come into the news here that will affect the lobster population. But instead, I will go to Joyce in Georgetown to ask the question herself. Hi, Joyce. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I was basically asking what you said. Would somebody please comment on the impact of the Trump tariffs on the lobster industry, particularly as it relates to competition with Canada?
Yeah. Any thoughts first to Chris?
Yes, absolutely. I think that, you know, it's likely that the tariffs, the Chinese tariffs, are going to have a brutal effect on the Maine lobster industry, but by how much is still unclear. When I think everyone's still in shock about it to some degree. During the first few days leading up to the tariff on July 6th, dealers and lobstermen were saying it may not be so bad, that lobsters are a luxury item in China, so the Chinese might not mind paying a little bit more. They might be able to absorb 25%, like as a cost. But now it's looking like lobster dealers are seeing that the Chinese are no longer buying like before, and in some cases they've completely cut off their orders to some wholesalers in Maine. So people are turning to Canada because Canada was even before the Chinese tariff, the Canadian lobster was cheaper than the Maine lobster because the European Union dropped their 8% tariff that they used to have on Canadian lobster, and that meant that Maine lobster became more expensive, relatively speaking. So I think it's a huge problem. It remains to be seen how big.
Yeah. Joyce, thank you very much.
Let's
go to Rick in Saco. Hi, Rick.
How you doing?
Good, thanks.
Great. Listen, I'm a marine scientist, and I'd like to propose this question to Bob. I've been an avid scuba diver in Maine for the last 40 years, and Bob will agree that the urchin industry crashed the market back through the 80s and early 90s. And the urchins are the lawnmowers of the seafloor. And I've noticed a huge difference in the last 20 years on the cover of macroalgae on the shores of Maine, at least in southern Maine anyway. And I think that my theory is it provides a lot more ground cover for juvenile lobsters. And I'd like to get Bob's opinion on that.
Right. You've got the story exactly right. The sea urchin fishery began in 1987. It peaked in 1993. It virtually collapsed since then. That is the only herbivore keeping the kelp and other seaweed mowed down. And so that has grown up. And especially on areas that are ledge covered, there's a lot more habitat for lobsters because lobsters tend not to just hang out on ledge. It would be like being exposed on a parking lot. So that is correct. And also, there's a lot of worms and other things that feed on the seaweed as it rots on the seafloor, and that's also eaten by lobsters to some degree. So it's an interesting example of how one fishery can actually have even a positive effect on another one.
1-800-399-3566. Rick, thank you for the call. We'll go now to Bryant Pond and to Glenn. Hi, Glenn. Welcome to Maine Calling.
Hi. Thanks so much. I wanted to ask about how the lobster industry is responding to another impact of climate change, which is that right whales, which are highly endangered, there's only 450 of them left, and which have been getting entangled in ropes from the lobster industry and dying, and they didn't have any babies at all this year. Climate change is causing them to move closer into lobster fishing areas, which is causing the increased entanglements. This has caused closures and other issues. What can the lobster industry do to address this, and how is it going to evolve in the future?
Yeah, Glenn, thank you. Bob, any thoughts?
Yes, well, it is a serious problem, and the lobster industry has been doing a lot in the last 10 years in terms of trying to minimize the amount of lines they have on the surface. I do want to point out that, ship strikes are a serious problem. Entanglement is a problem, but as far as I know, there's only been one entangled right whale that's been identified as being in from Maine fishing. And I do think that the right whale distributions, they too are under a big effect from climate change because one of their prey species, which is a type of copepod, looks almost like a shrimp of sorts, Calanus finmarcticus, it actually is less abundant in the mouth of the Bay of Fundy where they used to like to feed. So more of the right whales are actually going up into the Gulf of St. Lawrence, and that would be good. The more we get the right whales offshore and out of our waters, the better. But this is an ongoing and very serious problem, and I do know that the fishing industry is taking it very seriously.
All right. Glenn, thank you very much. We haven't talked, as I recall, about shell disease. It's been an issue that's popped up from time to time. And Bob, I just wondered, could you give us maybe a status report on, first of all, on what it is, and is it a growing issue?
Shell disease is a problem. I mean, it's been around for decades and decades, but the decline you talked about in southern New England, like in Rhode Island and Long Island Sound, that is from shell disease, and it's a pathogen that's been around, but suddenly, around 1998, 1999, which was the warmest year on the planet at the time, it became epidemic. We call that epizootic, and it erodes the shell so much that the lobsters literally can't molt. They actually can kill them, and in Rhode Island, there was an 80% decline of inshore lobsters as a result of shell disease. A lot of scientists think that it has to do with temperature stress, and roughly, 18 degrees C or roughly 64 degrees Fahrenheit, lobsters start getting stressed. At 68 degrees, it's a serious problem, and those are the temperatures they're getting south of Cape Cod. As Chris pointed out, the Gulf of Maine is a whole lot colder, and we're looking at, in western Maine, for example, off of Portland, temperatures that are less than 52, 53 degrees maximum on the seafloor. So we actually aren't seeing that much stress, and the shell disease, when it has flared up, has been on the order of 2 to 4% of the population. So for the foreseeable future, we don't see it as a problem, but we just simply can't take it off our radar.
Yeah, so are we really talking, what kind of temperature increase are we talking about that would have to happen, say, in Casco Bay before lobsters were no longer viable? You said what's it at now, 50?
Right, and I think this is a very important point, because some of the work that's been done, it's really great work, Gulf of Maine Research Institute has done some of this. They've looked at sea surface temperatures, but actually, as you all know, the lobsters crawl around on the sea floor. And the surface waters in the summertime get warm, but there's what we call a thermocline. So the bottom temperatures are a lot colder. And those colder temperatures, it surprises some people to know that you can get colder temperatures on the bottom in places of Casco Bay than you'll get off Jonesport in eastern Maine in the summer. And so these temperatures where the lobsters are living, by and large, are much cooler than we have to be concerned with. We've been seeing steady increase in temperature. It's been tracked since 1905 by Maine's Department of Marine Resources. But I think that we are actually several decades away from having to be any concern about the warm temperature stresses that you see in southern New England. And that's probably being conservative.
Yeah. Chris, do you want to weigh in on that and how that I guess, fits into the narrative of your book?
Well, one thing I wanted to weigh in on was just to ask Bob a question. Bob, do you think that ocean acidification could also be forcing shell disease to some degree?
That's a very interesting question. And, you know, there is some recent work that's looking at, aspects of the shell and ocean acidification. But lobsters are very different than clams and a lot of shellfish in that, in some laboratory studies, they've increased the carbon dioxide, which makes the water acidic, and the lobster's calcification rates went up, which is very surprising.
Really?
Some people have looked at temperature and acidification, and they find temperature tends to have a bigger effect than acidification, but I don't think we have a definitive word yet on how much acidification is going to have to occur before we start seeing real impacts on the lobster population.
Yeah, I see these statistics in the literature that the oceans have become 30% more acidic, but that must vary from place to place. The Gulf of Maine is not necessarily 30% more acidic, is it?
Right, and the details on that, because you can find estuaries that are much more acidic. You find deep water that can be more acidic. I think where the science is now is really looking at the detail about what are the rates and in what locations. And so it's hard to encapsulate it, but at this point, I don't think most scientists see acidification on the immediate, danger list of concerns we have. I absolutely bait. You know, the quota for herring is going to drop by something like 60 million pounds next year. That's going to be a big effect, and that's going to increase the price. And then one thing we didn't mention about the tariff is that lobstermen have been complaining to me about the cost of traps because the trap wire comes from outside the United States. So the cost of lobstering is going up, and I'm much more concerned about those aspects of the economics than I am necessarily about the biology.
And you mentioned earlier diversification. You think that's a critical part of sustaining a healthy lobster industry over decades?
Yeah, and I also think, a maritime, tradition, it requires this diversification. And that's not just some of the Black Sea bass and red hake that Carla was mentioning are coming in, but how do we diversify aquaculture in a sustainable way that doesn't have a negative impact on the ecosystem. We need to find more ways to bring the economic diversity up so that we can sustain our maritime heritage, or we're going to fall into the gentrification trap that Chris raised moments ago.
What are the prospects of, given some urgency of this, of using aquaculture to raise lobster? I know it's been a difficult task, but is that something that could be worked on?
That has been done for over a century without success. There are good ways of raising these lobsters. They've been released carefully. Of course, you have to be careful that they don't get eaten. When it's been done carefully with controls, they can't see any demographic effect. I think the bottom line is the dynamics of what nature can provide so outweighs what you can produce in a laboratory or in a culture setting that we just simply have to be good stewards of our marine environment, I think.
Yeah, Chris White, I'll give you the last word. What's the takeaway or the message, I guess, at the close of this conversation?
Well, I think what it is is that we have to look at the ecology of the Maine lobstermen, because it's not just about the ecology of the lobster. It's the ecology of the entire Maine lobsterman and his world. And it's being pressured from every corner. He's got challenges with climate change, with bait costs, with wire, as Bob just said, and the number of lobsters that are there to fish. And so we need to look at the whole situation and try to find remedies.
All right. Chris, Bob, thank you both for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Christopher White is the author of The Last Lobster. Bob Stenick is a marine biologist and professor with the Darling Marine Lab and University of Maine's School of Marine Sciences. John Keimel ran the board today. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as helpful links and resources, by visiting mainecalling.org. Today's show will be rebroadcast again tonight at 8 o'clock. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, Maine's historic sites and attractions. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.